Let's start this session with this glance meditation that I spoke about earlier, where I'll be slowly reading through the Heart Sutra, and then based on a little bit what we've been talking about that day, expand upon a bit, and then you can reflect on that so that we can start to get some understanding of the various parts of the Heart Sutra. So let's begin with that first. So as always, we begin by preparing the body, setting it in a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And settling the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. And now as I read through the Heart Sutra slowly, you can reflect on the meaning of the words, particularly the section we've covered already in class. The Heart of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra, Arya Bhagavati Prashna Paramita Hridaya Sutra. Thus did I hear at one time. The Bhagavan was dwelling on Massive Vulture's Mountain in Rajgir, together with a great community of monks and a great community of bodhisattvas. At that time, the Bhagavan was absorbed in the concentration on the categories of phenomena called profound perception. Also at that time, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara looked upon the very practice of the profound perfection of wisdom and beheld those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature. Not just the person is empty of inherent nature, but also the basis of the person, the body and the mind, or the five aggregates, are also empty of inherent nature. Then, through the power of Buddha, the Venerable Shariputra said this to the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara: "How should any son of the lineage train who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom?" Or in other words, how should someone who's interested in the Mahayana path practice the wisdom of emptiness? He said that, and the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara said this to the Venerable Sharadvatriputra: "Shariputra, any son of the lineage or daughter of the lineage who wishes to practice the activity of the profound perfection of wisdom should look upon it like this. Correctly and repeatedly beholding those five aggregates also as empty of inherent nature." Or in other words, to subsequently see in a correct way that the five aggregates also are empty of inherent nature. Meaning subsequent to investigation in a logical way, we'll come to see that not just the person, but the body and the mind are also empty of inherent nature. Form is empty. Empty of what? Empty of inherent existence. Form, or here the body, does not exist independently. It does not have any inherent existence. It does not exist from its own side. It does not have true existence. Even though it appears to exist independently, it does not exist in this way. It has no findable inherent existence. But of course that doesn't mean there's no form at all, no body at all. Because emptiness is form. Meaning, because of emptiness, things can appear and can function. And form and emptiness are not two contradictory things. Because emptiness is not other than form. Form is also not other than emptiness. In the same way, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness are empty. Meaning, just as the body is empty of independent existence, so too is the mind empty of independent existence. Shariputra, likewise, all phenomena are emptiness. Meaning all phenomena are empty of independent existence. Nothing exists independently. Without characteristic, unproduced, unceased, stainless, not without stain, not deficient, not fulfilled. Shariputra, therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, no consciousness. No I, no ear, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind. No visual form, no sound, no odor, no taste, no object of touch, and no phenomenon. There is no I element, and so on, up to and including no mind element, and no mental consciousness element. There is no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so on, up to and including no aging and death, and no extinction of aging and death. Similarly, there is no suffering, origination, cessation, and path. There is no exalted wisdom, no attainment, and also no non-attainment. Shariputra, therefore, because there is no attainment, Bodhisattvas rely on and dwell in the perfection of wisdom. The mind without obscuration and without fear. Having completely passed beyond error, they reach the end point of nirvana. All the Buddhas who dwell in the three times also manifestly completely awaken to unsurpassable, perfect, complete enlightenment in reliance on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, the mantra of the perfection of wisdom, the mantra of great knowledge, the unsurpassed mantra, the mantra equal to the unequaled, the mantra that thoroughly pacifies all suffering, should be known as truth, since it is not false. The mantra of the perfection of wisdom is declared. Tayata, om, gate, gate, paragati, parasamgati, bodhi, svaha. Shariputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva should train in the profound perfection of wisdom like that. Then the Bhagavan arose from that concentration and commended the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara saying, well said, son of the lineage, it is like that. It is like that one should practice the profound perfection of wisdom, just as you've indicated. Even the Tathagatas rejoice. The Bhagavan having thus spoken, the Venerable Sharadvatriputra, the Bodhisattva Mahasattva Arya Avalokiteshvara, those surrounding in their entirety, along with the world of gods, humans, asuras, and gandhavas were overjoyed and highly praised that spoken by the Bhagavan. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. To rest in its own place. Resting in awareness itself. Without trying to do anything at all, just rest. Resting in pristine, pure awareness. So we're currently looking at the statement, form is empty. Of course, this means form is empty of inherent existence or independent existence. And there are, as we briefly saw in the last session, there are a number of ways of coming to understand that. So remember in the previous brief explanation, we could translate it as to subsequently see in a correct way, meaning we need to investigate things to see how they really exist. And we need to do that through very clear, methodical, logical reasoning, a clear, methodical investigation. And we briefly mentioned at least five ways of investigating. A number of those for a beginner are a little bit difficult because they're looking at from the perspective of the cause or the result. Whereas the fourth one, this same or different investigation, is the one we're looking at now, which looks at the thing itself, investigates the entity, the object itself, which is a little bit easier as a beginner. And then the fifth one, the reasoning of dependent arising, is we're going to look at that in the next statement, emptiness is form. So we're currently looking at this reasoning of same or different, sometimes called one or many. And that is usually presented as what's called the four essential points, meaning four points that we need to go through in our investigation. And the first point, the one we've briefly looked at already, identifying the target, or usually in the text it's called, the technical term is identifying the object of negation, is the most important point of the process of the meditation. Meaning we need to get a clear picture of this me that seems to be here. If we don't have that clear picture of this me that seems to be here, and we search, investigate, we're not really going to come to any conclusion. So I'm going to read a little bit about this point from this book here again, How to See Yourself as You Really Are. Is a book that I can recommend as a beginning book for emptiness and understanding ignorance and dependent arising. And this, he talks about these four essential points in here, and I want to read from page 129. And it's called here, Four Steps to Realization. There are four major steps toward realizing that you do not exist the way you think you do. I will discuss these briefly first and then in detail. The first step is to identify the ignorant beliefs that must be refuted. You need to do this because when you perform analysis, seeking yourself within body and mind or separate from body and mind, and you do not find it, you could wrongly conclude that you utterly do not exist. Because the I appears to our minds to be established in and of itself, when we use analysis to try to find it and it is not found, it seems that the I does not exist at all, whereas it is only the independent I, the inherently existent I, that does not exist. Because there is a danger here of stumbling into denial and nihilism, it is crucial as a first step to understand what is being negated in selflessness. How does I appear to your mind? It does not appear to exist through the force of thought, rather it appears to exist more concretely. You need to notice and identify this mode of apprehension. It is your target. The second step, which we haven't come to yet, but I'll talk about it here, is to determine that if the I exists the way it seems to be, It must be either one with the mind or mind and body, or separate from the mind and body. After ascertaining that there is no other possibilities, in the final two steps, you analyze to see whether the I and the body-mind complex can either be one inherently established entity or different inherently established entities. As we will discuss in the following sections, through meditation, you gradually will come to understand that there are fallacies with I being either of these. At that point, you can readily realize that an inherently existent I is unfounded. This is realization of selflessness or emptiness. Then, when you have realized that the I does not inherently exist, it is easy to realize that the mind does not inherently exist. So now he talks about this first step, identifying the target in a little bit more detail. He says, usually, no matter what appears to our minds, it seems to exist from its own side, independent of thought. When we pay attention to an object, whether it be yourself, another person, body, mind, or a material thing, we accept how it appears as if this is its final inner real condition. This can be clearly seen at times of stress, such as when someone else criticizes you for something you have not done. You ruined such and such. You suddenly think very strongly, I didn't do that. And you might even shout at the accuser. How does I appear to your mind at that moment? How does this I that you value and cherish so much seem to exist? How are you apprehending it? By reflecting on these questions, you can get a sense of the way the mind naturally and innately apprehends I as existing from its own side, inherently. Let us take another example. When there is something important you are supposed to do, and you discover that you forgot to do it, you can get angry at your own mind. Oh, my awful memory! When you get angry at your own mind, the I that is angry and the mind at which you are angry appear to be separate from each other. The same thing happens when you get upset with your body or a part of your body, such as your hand. The I that is angry seems to have its own being in and of itself, distinct from the body at which you are angry. On such occasions, you can observe how the I seems to stand by itself, as if it is self-instituting, as if it is established by way of its own character. To such a consciousness, the I does not appear to be set up in dependence upon body and mind. Can you remember a time when you did something awful and your mind thought, I really made a mess of things? At that moment, you identified with a sense of I that has its own concrete entity, that is neither mind nor body, but something that appears much more strongly. Or remember a time when you did something wonderful, or something really nice happened to you, and you took great pride in it. This I that is so valued, so cherished, so liked, is the object of such self-importance, and is the object of such self-importance, was so concretely and vividly clear. At such times, our sense of I is particularly obvious. Once you catch hold of such a blatant manifestation, you can cause this strong sense of I to appear to your mind, and without letting the way it seems diminish in strength, you can examine, as if from a corner, whether it exists in a solid way, in the solid way it appears. The remaining three steps discussed in the following three chapters are aimed at understanding that this sort of I, which we believe in so much and which drives so much of our behavior, actually is a figment of our imagination. This solid I does not exist at all. For the subsequent steps to work, it is crucial to identify and stay with this strong sense of a self-instituting I. So, again, this is the most important point in this whole process, is to get this clear picture of how this I, this me, seems to exist. The second step is, and again I'll use the same terminology as in His Holiness' book, limiting the possibilities. Normally in the texts, the technical word used here is ascertaining the pervasion. What this means is, if there really is this concrete, independent, self-existent I that seems to be here, if it really does exist, it must be findable. We must be able to point somewhere and say, there it is. And so the second step is all about understanding where to search. Where could this I possibly exist? And it can only exist in one of two places. Either the same as the body and mind, or different than the body and the mind. Meaning, if we search in those two places and we don't find it, it does not exist. So that's what limiting the possibilities means, is to understand where to search, and if we can't find it in those places, it cannot exist. So we haven't started searching yet. So that's only the second step, is to know where we have to search. For example, let's say we're looking for a particular person in a house. Then we need to know, of course, all the places to search in the house. So let's say the house has just two rooms. So we need to know, okay, to see if this person's in the house, I have to search in room A and room B. And if I search in both of those rooms and I don't find them, they're not in the house. So that's the second example. If we search amongst the body and the mind, and different than the body and mind, we don't find the I, it does not exist, the independent I. Because if it really is independent, it must be findable. Then we search. And we can do the search in either order, but generally it's listed as same or different, meaning, is the I, the me, that seems to be here, is it the same as the body and the mind? Meaning, can we find it in the body and the mind? And different means, then, if we can't find it as the same as the body and the mind, if it exists, it must be something different than the body and the mind. And so if we search in these two places and we don't find it, it does not exist. Remember, what doesn't exist is the independent I. Now, when we do the search in terms of same and different, actually in this book, when it addresses these two searches, it does so in terms of logical absurdities, meaning if, for example, a simple example is, there seems to be this single me here. If it's the same as the body and the mind, then because there are two things, there's body and mind, there must be two me's, as an example. And there are many, and there are a number of other logical absurdities that are mentioned here. But we can make it even more simple than that, and we can simply search and see if we can find the me somewhere here amongst the body and the mind. And when we do the search, we can search first in the body and then in the mind, or vice versa. And then, of course, if we don't find the me amongst the body and the mind, the only other place it could be is something different than the body and the mind, which means we must be able to take away the body and the mind and be left with a me somewhere. And so we can do it in that way. We can sort of take away the body and the mind and see if we can pinpoint the me somewhere, if it's different than the body and the mind. I mean, the only sort of logical place, sensible place, really, it could be is here. But to be complete, we also need to check here. Because we never really have a sense of me completely separate than the body and the mind. But to be complete, to search everywhere, we do this anyway. And if we don't find the me in either of these two places, then there is no independent me. And that, if we come to that not finding experience, we hold that experience, because that is a experience of emptiness. Emptiness is the not finding of that independent me. Now, generally what happens in this meditation is, as a beginner, the most common fault or problem with the meditation people experience is the first point. Is when they start doing the search, instead of searching for this me that seems to be vividly here, people start searching for their intellectual idea of who they think they are. Of course, our behavior is not based on some philosophical idea of who we think we are. Our behavior is based on our instinctive sense of me. So that's the me we need to look for. So that's why the first step is the most important. Otherwise, we start going in the search and we go, oh yes, the me is the continuum of the mind, because that's the thing that goes from life to life. There's the me there. But this is not the me that we are identifying with when someone is accusing us of doing something we never did. So that's why it's important to have the clear picture of the me as it appears to us in our experience, not according to some abstract intellectual thinking about who the me really is, because that's not the me we're relating to in our behavior. So that's why the first step is the most important. Then, of course, what can happen is that we don't follow the search in a very clear way, and then we end up with no conclusion. So that's why it's important, the second step, to understand if we search there and there, and we don't find, it cannot exist. And then, even if we do the search well and we don't find, then the most common experience at that time is fear. And that is, as I've mentioned earlier, because for us now there's just two possibilities. There either is this me here or there's no me. Because the only me that we've identified with our entire life is this independent me that really seems to be here. That's the only me we really know. And if we start to search for this me, and we don't seem to be able to find it, then experientially, often it feels like we're going out of existence. So if this is your experience in this meditation, it's actually a very good sign. It means you're doing the search in a very good way, but all that's happening is you're coming to the wrong conclusion. You're concluding that just because we don't seem to be able to find it, It doesn't exist. And therefore, fear arises. So, two things we can do if you find fear arising. One, of course, is immediately, if fear is coming up, you can ask the question, who is having the fear? Because if you don't exist, there can't be fear. So there is a me here. Otherwise there can't be fear. So don't worry, you're not going out of existence. But of course, the longer term solution to that is to understand this view of emptiness, particularly the next part, which we're going to cover, the view of dependent arising. That there is a me, and the me is a dependent me. So this can help. So what it often says in the text is that people who are not familiar with the view of emptiness and dependent arising often have fear coming up because they misinterpret the experience as being, oh, I'm going out of existence. Whereas someone who's familiar with the view of emptiness and dependent arising and they have this experience of not finding, instead of fear, they have a lot of joy because they'll come to realize that this me that I've believed in my entire life and has caused me so much drama and suffering simply doesn't exist. And then they have a lot of joy when they realize that. So, and then the recommendation is if we do this search and we don't find, then we hold that not finding. We stop searching and we just hold that not finding experience. And that not finding is an experience of emptiness. And we try to hold that as long as we can. But again, generally what happens is we start to get simply distracted by something or that experience just becomes some spaced out experience. If that happens, recommendation is go back and do the search again and hold again. That's why the shamatha practice is important, so that we can do the clear search and then when this experience comes to hold that experience longer. The longer we can hold that, the more it will penetrate our mind. So this is the four essential points. And as His Holiness mentioned in his book, as a beginner in this first step, it's often helpful to think of a situation where there was a strong sense of me. So he used a couple of examples, being criticized, being praised, something good happening. Usually when we have these things happening, there's a strong sense of me, you know. How dare you accuse me of that? Or, I did something very good. You know, we have a strong sense of me. Because normally when we sit down and calm the body and calm the mind, the sense of me is not as strong. And so then as a beginner it may be difficult to get the clear picture of this me. So therefore it's good as a beginning point to think of some little situation where there was a strong sense of me. Then look at that, get a clear picture of that, and keep that in mind when we're doing the search. And actually you're going to be doing this meditation with Jonas in the next session. And I think he'll use one of these examples to think of some situation where you have that sense of me and then get that clear picture and then do the search. So that's the process. Any questions on that? Anything not clear?
Identifying the target, I feel completely lost and hopeless. When you say latch onto a strong...
Well, not too strong. Otherwise we get unwell.
So when you say that, I'm thinking me is my autobiography. Or
when someone... So remember here, we're talking about experiential. We're not talking about who we think we are.
Okay, I'm thinking of
If I accuse you of something you never did, do you think of your autobiography at that point? Right at that point? I think we don't. So that's not the me we're identifying with. We're not identifying with our autobiography when someone is accusing us. There's usually this me. You're accusing me. And usually when someone's accusing us, it seems to be somewhere here, doesn't it? If someone's verbally attacking us, normally the sense of me seems to be somewhere around here, doesn't it? Normally.
Perhaps, yeah.
I think.
Maybe your temperature goes up, your flesh.
Yeah, but again, we're not looking at the temperature. We're it's me. They're accusing me. Right? So again, we need to just look at that. Look at that. So again, this is not an intellectual process. If we make the first step intellectual, we've gone wrong. If we start thinking, me, okay, is that my history or is it my personality, or then we've lost it. Because we're not relating to these things. No, I mean, you get feelings associated. It's just this me. Again, it's, we just look at me. We're not trying to work it out. We're not trying to see where it is. We're not trying to determine, is it this, is it that? We're just looking. So, like example, we're going to look for a person in a room. The first step is to get a clear picture of them. So all we do is we look at them. That's all. We don't go, oh, I wonder if they've come from this country, or I wonder, you know, how old they are, or I wonder who their mother is. That's of no interest in this situation. All we got to do is just look and see the clear picture, and then we can look for that person in the room. So that's the first step. So that's right. We're not trying to work out anything here. We're not trying to do anything except just get in touch with that me. That's all.
I knew to identify it. So I kind of like looked at myself, but outside of myself, and telling my brain to breathe slowly instead of, you know, ventilated. So is that the, like some, it wasn't exactly my brain that was saying, like I was telling my brain to, you know, to relax my body. So do you mean kind of like in the sense of that?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean, but I mean that's what we need to do. We need to sort of step back and look at this me. And so maybe that's what you're doing. Because while we're really caught up in it,
yeah,
then, of course, we react. Because
exactly.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, went, like, outside of myself and kind of, like...
Well, but, I mean, here, the first step is to observe this me. Yes. So it's in that sense...
But it's like observing the mind and the body.
But we're not sort of imagining that...
No.
Looking at the body.
Yeah, I'm like, you know, I'm doing the... But, yeah.
I mean, but, yeah, here we're trying to observe the me.
Yeah, to be natural in order to control the situation.
Mm. And if we're looking at the me, of course, we're not getting caught up so much, yes.
Can we say it's more feeling? It's more inside?
Again, if someone is verbally accusing us, we'll have physical sensations associated with the me, but that's not me, is it? That's physical sensations. So again, the first step, we're not trying to find the me. We're just trying to get a clear picture, that's all. And we're not trying to figure it out. We're not trying to theorize. We're not trying to ask any questions. We're just looking. That's it. Right.
In this process, at times you're able to negate the independent I, but then suddenly, in fact, the tendency is to catch the dependent I. And then, dependent I starts behaving as if it is the independent I, in real situations, in life situations, especially if you're in a situation of, you know, authority or a seniority. People look at you and they want you to act as the I. You know, to decide things, to control things, and then suddenly you forget the dependence.
Of course. Of course. I mean, of course, as a beginner, our experience of, if we come to some experience of the dependent I in our behavior, that won't be very stable, and stimulus will overwhelm that, and we'll start grasping onto me, me, me again, and then it's gone. Well, of course, is to stabilize it. Again, we need the shamatha practice, and we need to continue to work on the emptiness practice. And then if we have that more stable, then that experience of emptiness will linger into daily life. And then by default, we'll be operating from the dependent me. We won't be grasping onto the independent me.
But it's okay to accept that the dependent me should act as the dependent me in the world, the way the world expects it to act. What I'm trying to say is...
I'm not sure I'm understanding what you're saying.
Okay, I'll try and explain it again. Within your own self, you accept the negation of the independent I. In theory, it works there. But then when you step out, you have a role, you have a responsibility, you have a position.
Sure.
And then, to keep it in mind that yes, to fulfill that role or responsibility or position, there is the dependent I which is still required.
There, yes.
Which needs to act in a certain way, which needs to do certain things, which needs to... So what I'm saying is, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
The problem is that in the course of, journey of the dependent I, it assumes the independent.
Well, that's right, because we still have ignorance, and so we start grasping onto ourselves and others. I mean, that's just normal. I mean, to be in that state without grasping, we're more or less out of samsara, no? So what I'm saying is that if we develop this view intellectually and we start to meditate on it and we start to have some experience of it, and then in daily life, we start to question appearances and try to not release the grasping, then our way of behavior will be more in accord with reality and less reactive. Of course, we can't expect overnight to be let... if we've got rid of ignorance, we're out of samsara. But the more that we can do this meditation, the more that we can work on this illusory-like emptiness in daily life, and we have to consciously do that, of course, the more helpful that will be in our behavior. The more in harmony we will be, the less reactive, the less mental afflictions. But this is a long-term process.
So, for me, naturally, when you say me, for me, it's the mind.
Okay, if you hurt your knee and you go, I am hurt, are you relating to the mind?
If you're talking about the language, because what I'm coming from is what you are asking me to do is to search the me. So
to search for the me within the body and me. Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is, what I am going to do is search for the me.
Correct.
And both of them are I and me are the
same. So, of course, the person who's doing the search is the person who exists, the dependent me. Of course. But that's not the me that we're identifying with, is it, in our behavior? If we were identifying with the dependent me, we would never have any mental afflictions, we would never have any suffering. But that's not the me we're relating to in our behavior. We're identifying with the independent me. That's the me we need to search for. So again, we need to be careful that we don't turn this into an intellectual exercise. And I think it seems like that's what you're doing, is you're searching, you go, actually the me is this continuum of the mind, because that's the thing that goes on from life to life. That's the me.
It's I'm not sure if it is even intellectual, because it's so natural. There is this reflective capability of the mind which looks at itself. And for me, when you say search for me, I use this reflective capability of mind to look at itself and say, here is...
Yeah, but we're not looking at the mind, remember. We're looking for the me. So, how tall are you? How tall are you?
How tall is my body?
No, how tall are you? Huh? 5'11". Is your mind 5'11" tall? No. So there's a case that you're not identifying with the mind as me. Because I'm 5'11 tall. The mind's not 5'11 tall. And when someone's accusing you, also I think similar. You're not really identifying so much with the mind. So that's why we need to keep it as our direct experience and not drift off into some intellectual game, because then we're just lost. Because we're not identifying with the subtle continuum of the mind when someone's accusing us. I'm sure we're not. If we were, we wouldn't react. No.
I am not, like, more easy to understand that than I can explain it. I was like,
so you're saying it's easier to focus on another person than yourself? Is that what you're saying?
There's another person. You
compare?
Yeah, and it's like her, she, that's the bridge in mind. Like the person here.
Okay.
And me is going to be something more.
Me is something more than...
Yeah, something like... That's difficult to explain. It's more like...
Okay, maybe we can go back to the physical example. See if we can work on this a little bit. So remember, like in Chandrakirti's text, when he went through his reasoning, which was similar to this. I mean, he had it more expanded, but it's the same reasoning. Then he used a chariot, but I don't have a chariot here, so I'll use a pen. So effectively, the same, the reasoning of the same is, there really seems to be a pen here. You know, instinctively, we say this is a pen. But is there a pen? Can we find a pen here somewhere? So, as Chandrakirti did, he said, you know, is this a pen? You know, he took a bit off the chariot and said, is this a chariot? You know, is this a pen? And then he goes, is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? This tube? Is this tube a pen? Is the ink inside a pen? Is this round ball on the end a pen? Is this metal thing a pen? Where's the pen? There's no pen to be found there. But then people go, oh, that's easy. It's just the collection of all of that. So then Chandrakirti goes, well, here's the collection. You know, is that a pen? And then you go, oh, no, no, it has to be in a certain shape. So that's also one of Chandrakirti's things. Oh, it's the shape. Okay. So you need to tell me when there's a pen. Okay. No? Oh, what about that? Huh? So, what we can understand, and this is what Chandrakirti was saying, is the pen, or the chariot, the pen is not any of the individual parts, and it's not the collection of the parts. It's something that is labelled depending on the collection of the parts. There's no pen to be found anywhere amongst any of this stuff. That we just have stuff, and then based on that stuff, we label pen. Because we interpret that in a certain way. So we bring the pen into existence through our interpretation. There's no pen, independent pen there amongst that basis. Because if the pen was there, it would mean that a dog came in the door, the dog would think pen. Dog doesn't see pen. maybe some sort of chewing stick. Or if there's a tiny little ant here, an ant does not see pen, it would see maybe a home. So there's no pen to be found in the basis. But that's what we instinctively, how we instinctively relate to the pen. Experientially, we say this is a pen. This is a pen. And that's how we behave. Same with person. That there's just a lot of stuff here. And of course with the person, there's not just physical stuff, there's mental stuff. But it's just a collection of stuff. The five aggregates, collection of stuff. And if we look at in that stuff, for the person that seems to be there, there's no person to be found in the stuff. Person is something labeled on the basis of that stuff. But again, that's not the person we relate to. The person we relate to is independent me. Like we relate to this is a pen, as if there's a pen there from its own side. That's the pen we believe in and we relate to. The me we relate to is this independent me that really seems to be here from its own side, not merely something that's merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. If we related to that dependent me, we, according to Buddhism, we would be out of samsara, we would never have any mental afflictions or any suffering. So the me that we're looking for is the same as the pen that we're looking for that seems to be there. So that's, I don't know if that helps. Yeah.
How did the Buddhism see the idea of the story in another time? Like, because they say about the idea of the story, as I understand it.
The idea of what, sorry?
Soul.
Oh, soul.
That,
yeah.
You know, like, there is no, you know, body or mind without the soul. But soul is not something that you can grasp. Although you know the theory of if someone dies, this 21 grams, whatever, you know, and this is actually the soul.
So, yeah. So again, to answer the question, what does Buddhism say about soul? Of course, first we have to define the word soul.
It's kind of like something like the need, in a way.
Could be. I mean, it depends on how we define the word soul. I mean, I think even in Christianity there are probably differences of opinion about what the soul is. I'm sure there are. So what we're saying here is, like, well, again, the pen and then the person. The pen, there's no pen to be found there amongst the stuff. Pen is just a label we're applying to that collection of stuff. Meaning there's nothing more than that stuff there. There's not something in addition. There's not a pen that's in addition to the stuff, is there? It's not something extra there, a pen. Yeah? You right so far? Okay. Like that, there's a collection of stuff here. Part of that stuff is the body, which is a collection of material stuff. The mind is a collection of mental stuff. Yeah? And the me is not something in addition to that stuff. There's nothing more than that stuff here. Meaning, if your idea of soul is something extra, something more than the body and the mind, Buddhism would reject that idea.
Yeah, but in this point, that's easy to understand that it's inside. It's all the collection, like what you said for the pen. Like the body, the mind, the soul, is together.
But then, where is the soul? Is it the body? Is it the mind?
It's both.
It's both.
It's all.
It's all.
Yes.
So soul is a label you're applying to the body and the mind?
Yeah, you can.
Then that soul exists. That's the dependent me. So no problem.
Okay.
If that's really your idea of soul. If soul is a label you're applying to the collection, that's the me. That exists. That's a dependent me. But I think a lot of people don't, wouldn't say the soul is that. Oh, I don't know. But I mean, that's what I hear. I often hear that the soul is something other. there's like the body and the mind, and then there's the soul, a third thing, like something separate. Huh?
I just remember seeing the concept of spirit in the Buddhist literature, but not never the word soul. But one interesting question, because this is quite topical right now, regarding Michael Schumacher. What is the Buddhist view on if the person has brain damage and not able to communicate? Is the eye still there?
Or? Yeah, yes. At all stages. It just means that, of course, if the brain is damaged, the coarse mind can't function very well because that's the support of it, that's all. But there's a me, you know. There's a Michael Schumacher there in hospital, yes, of course. In not a very good physical and mental state, obviously. Yeah.
I read a book you recommended of Thich Nhat
Hanh. About the Heart Sutra?
Yes.
Yes.
And maybe I misunderstood him, but it will explain it the other way around. It will say the pen is made of a plastic that was produced by a worker in China.
That's the next part of the explanation. That's the emptiness is form. I haven't got there yet. No. We haven't got there yet. That's the next topic. That's the next topic.
Because it seems easier to understand.
I mean, yes and no. It's easier to understand, but it's easy to get stuck in a partial understanding. You know, when we talk about this dependency, dependent arising, we think that means that there are two things which are connected or dependent, but we're still holding on to those things. So yes, at an easy level, dependent arising is helpful, and that's what we're going to be talking about. And that can be helpful in appreciating emptiness, but the texts say that to really realize dependent arising directly is more difficult than emptiness. That you first realize emptiness directly, and then you directly realize that everything is a dependent arising. But yes, as a beginner, it's helpful, and that's the fifth of the reasons, the reasoning of dependent arising, and that's what we're going to be looking at next to help us with this task. Yes, that's coming.
Yeah, again, going back to the analogy of the pen and actually just preparing myself for meditation. If I'm doing meditation and if I'm asked to search for me, finally if I come and say, okay, this collection of things put in this particular form is me, and then I get stuck there. So how do I unstuck and then say, you know what, this is not me I'm looking for.
So if we find something that we believe to be me, then we can ask questions, because if that's me, then what we found must have all the characteristics of me, because it's me. So often people point to their body and say, this is me. Yeah. And then you can go, well, you know, the thing you found, this body you found, you know, you can ask questions like, does this have thoughts? Does this think? Or if you find something in the mind, you can ask questions like, well, if that's the me, then, you know, I'm 5'11". So is the thing I found, is that 5'11"? Because that's me. So if it's me, it must have all the characteristics of me.
So we're taking the body and mind separately, but if I say the me that I'm labeling is...
Right, so again, that's the thing, that's often the thing that in this search, often people can do the search and they go, and they can understand they're not the body. And sometimes they also look at the mind, they understand they're not the mind. But then they say, well, it's because I'm the collection of that. But remember, we're looking for an independent me, a findable me. So if the body is not me, that's a non-me. If the mind is not me, that's a non-me. If we put two non-me's together, what do we get? a collection of two non-me's, don't we? Like, for example, we're looking for an apple in a bowl of fruit, and here's a banana, here's an orange, not apples. We put banana and orange together, do we get an apple? No. We don't, do we? Because remember, again, we're looking for a findable, independent me. We're looking for a me that does not depend on anything else to exist. That's the me we're relating with. The me that does exist, of course, is the dependent me, the me that it is dependent on the body and the mind. So there's a difference between saying the me is dependent on the body and the mind, and the me is the body and the mind. You can't depend on the body and the mind and be it. Not possible. And the me we're identifying with is the me that seems to be usually some part of the body and the mind. That's the me we're grasping onto. That's the me we need to look for.
But when you die, they say that your soul or whatever is going to the next stage and then coming back, like in, you know, so what is that?
What is that is, in this chart here, remember we looked at the tenet systems chart, and I said each of the schools, this illustration of person, you know, if they want to point to what is actually the person, particularly in terms of life to life, we see that most of them say it's this continuum of the mind. Yeah. But then we look at the Prasangika assertions, what we're following, it says the mere I, which is imputed depending on the five aggregates. Yeah, but the mind is not me. Either we are the mind or we have a mind. Are you the mind or do you have a mind? No, I mean, we have a mind, don't we? Don't we? Isn't the mind part of us? Yes. So we have a mind. If we have a mind, we can't be the mind. You can't have something and be it. Like the cognitive fusion. Either we are our thoughts or we have thoughts. Either we are our emotions or we have emotions. The person. See, the thing is, and that's the difficulty, a couple of points have come up. We demand that for something to exist, it must be findable. We must be able to point to it and say, that's it. But the Prasangika view is saying that that findability is grasping. That's actually the problem.
Okay.
The problem is we believe everything's findable and graspable and exists in itself. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. So you won't find anything that goes from life to life because nothing is findable. But again, for us, not findable sort of implies it doesn't exist. And that's the problem. Is we're stuck in this these two extremes. Like here, cup, you know, we say this is a cup. The cup is this stuff, don't we? Normally we say the cup is the collection of this stuff. But what this view is saying is there's no cup in that collection of stuff. Cup is something that we're labeling depending on that collection of stuff. So the cup is not the collection of the stuff. The cup is labeled depending on the collection of the stuff. So the cup depends on that stuff. Like, we are not the body and the mind. The person is labeled depending on the body and the mind. The person depends on the body and the mind. In that way. Slowly, slowly. last question, then we have to stop. Today.
Identifying the target is the sense, the so-called controller or master, which to spot?
It can be. Again, see, when we have this sense of me, that me that appears to us can be based on many different things, depending on the situation. For example, you know, if we hurt our ankle, then we can have this thing, I am hurt. Then the I that appears is based on the ankle. Or if we have some anger coming up in the mind, we can go, oh, I'm angry. I am angry because of the mind. So the basis from which the I appears can be many. And it can be that the basis can be we're looking at the body in terms of trying to do something with the body. And so then we can say, I am trying to relax this body. Yeah.
And swap, is it?
Same idea, yeah. Okay, let's stop there. So tomorrow we're going to look at that, hopefully it'll help us to look at that emptiness is form, which is sort of the flip side, the dependent arising side, and then hopefully that will also help us to better understand emptiness, because the statement after says form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form, meaning that this idea of emptiness is not something different than the idea of everything interdependent. So if we can appreciate the idea of interdependency, that can help us to appreciate emptiness. But that's coming tomorrow morning. So let's stop there, have a break. Then you'll be doing a little emptiness meditation based on this with Jonas, and then again, compassion-based practice this evening. And I'll see you tomorrow morning at 9. Continue on.